The Southern Baptist Convention is trying to resolve, once and for all, a long-standing dispute among its members, whether or not to rebrand itself. The debate is about dropping the word Southern. First, a little history. The convention split from the Baptist Church back in 1845, in part because of a dispute over whether slaveholders could be missionaries. In 1995, the SBC apologized for its past support of slavery and segregation, and the nation's largest Protestant denomination is working hard on outreach. But some of its members are concerned that the legacy evoked by its Southern title is hurting its case. Joining us now to talk more about this is the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, Pastor Bryant Wright. Pastor, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you today.
Now, you called a task force to debate the issue of the name change. How was this issue first raised with you? I mean, essentially, what was the argument made by those who wanted to drop the word Southern from the Southern Baptist Convention?
Especially from younger pastors beginning new churches in different parts of the country, Southern is not exactly a draw for people in thinking about a church they might be interested in going to. One of our pastors in New England talked about starting a church for the Yankee Baptist Convention in Birmingham, and it probably wouldn't be a tremendous draw there in Birmingham in doing that.
Right.
So the regional aspect is really the reason for doing this study.
So the executive committee charged with dealing with this issue recommended that churches have a choice, that they can essentially call themselves Southern Baptist still if they want to go with that name. But the alternative is the Great Commission Baptist. Where does the term Great Commission come from?
It comes from the charge that Jesus Christ gave his disciples to go and make disciples of all nations. And it's really kind of the final charge that Christ gave before he ascended to heaven.
This is in Matthew?
This is in Matthew 28, verses 19 and 20.
Over the years, the Southern Baptist Convention has dealt with its pro-slavery and pro-segregation past. I mean, back in 1995, he issued a public apology and a resolution. But is there still a sense that a stigma remains?
I think certainly among African Americans, Audie, the issue of our beginning leading up to the Civil War, that's a heritage that is lingering there. Now, certainly in the mid-90s, in the Atlanta Convention, when we sought the forgiveness of African Americans for our strain of racism, for our founding that was related to slavery, that has greatly helped in reaching African Americans. And we now have literally thousands of Southern Baptist congregations that are mostly African American.
This has been a long-going discussion. What does it say to you that this is the year that people talked about it so seriously?
Well, it's interesting that this has been studied or discussed about, I think it's 13 times since 1903. It's been an issue that just wouldn't go away. And because our North American Mission Board has such a huge focus on planting new churches outside the South, this is a perfect time for us to examine, do we have an unnecessary man-made barrier that might hinder new churches from reaching people in their community? So that was really the thrust of having the study at this time.
Well, Pastor Wright, thank you so much for explaining to us.
Very good to talk with you, Audie.
Pastor Bryant Wright, president of the Southern Baptist Convention, the entire convention will vote on the naming recommendation in June.
This is NPR News.
President Obama has apologized for the burning of copies of the Quran. The books were burned at a military base in Afghanistan. His apology follows days of demonstrations that have left a number of Afghans and two American soldiers dead. The thing is we're going to hear that in the Islamic faith, it is actually permitted to burn the Quran. It's all in how and why you do it. Turns out that in many religions, not just Islam, there are customs for disposing of sacred texts when they become old or damaged. NPR's Allison Keyes reports.
The Quran is considered to be the speech of God to humankind, word for word, explains Imam Jahari Abdul Malik.
The traditional way of disposing of used or damaged copies of the text of the Quran is by burning it.
But the director of outreach for the Dar al-Hajira Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia, says that doesn't include burning it with the trash. That's what U.S. officials say mistakenly happened with the Qurans in Afghanistan. The imam, who spent time there in November of 2010, says the troops should have asked for guidance.
If one said, well, we're burning some Qurans today, that wouldn't incite riot in Afghanistan. The problem is when one puts the malicious malicious intent as a part of the burning.
Imam Malik says the assumption there is that Americans disrespect Muslims, and that's why there would be such a visceral response to burning the Quran, even though a layperson could do so under Muslim law, as long as the intent was respectful. The Quran may also be buried. It should be wrapped in something pure and buried in a place where people do not walk. Many of the religious leaders we spoke to agreed that burial was the most respectful way to dispose of their sacred texts. In the Greek Orthodox Church, Bishop Adania says either a layperson or a clergyman could put the Holy Scripture to rest.
The appropriate way, if it was necessary to dispose of that item, it become torn or worn or aged, would either be to bury it or to burn it.
The bishop, who was chancellor of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America, says no specific ceremony is involved.
In the case of most lay people, they would bring it to their church and let the parish priest dispose of it.
The Torah is... it's handled with an enormous amount of respect.
Rabbi Menachem Ganach of the Orthodox Union explains.
Generally what's done is sacred texts are buried.
Ganach is the rabbinic administrator and CEO of the OU Kosher. He explains that Shemus, documents containing the name of God in Hebrew, are treated in a similar manner.
You can't just burn them or throw them in the garbage. So what is normally done is either they're buried, as a Torah would be, or they're put away.
The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America doesn't have an official policy for the disposal of Bibles, but Reverend Donald McCoy says...
For some, it would be burying, which would be a sacred thing to do, just as you would bury a loved one.
It should never be not seen to be revered or valued and treasured.
Monsignor Kevin Irwin is talking about the Bible. The Catholic University professor says he also prefers disposal by burial.
Because it is so sacred, and you don't want it to be perceived to be disgraced by even by burning.
The sense of the sacred is also paramount at the Baha'i National Center in Evanston, Illinois.
We feel that Baha'u'llah was a divine figure.
Thomas Murphy explains that the Baha'i faith is centered around a figure equal in stature to Jesus or Muhammad or Krishna, and his words are to be treated with respect.
There are no ceremonies attached to the treatment of books containing the sacred word.
Murphy says the disposal of books containing their sacred text must be done with a sense of dignity and reverence. Allison Keyes, NPR News.
Ever since September 11th, 2001, the New York City Police Department has aggressively gathered intelligence to prevent another terror attack. Now those tactics are provoking controversy in New Jersey. As NPR's Joel Rose reports, local officials were upset to learn the NYPD is monitoring Muslims well beyond the city limits.
Activists in New Jersey are outraged by what they see as an overly broad investigation into the lives of law-abiding Muslims. Mohammed El Falali is with the Islamic Center of Passaic County. He spoke today at a press conference in Newark.
It's unconstitutional, un-American. If there is a lead, by all means, I totally agree that there should be an investigation. There should be a safety of our country comes first, but not at the jeopardy of our civil liberties.
Falali is reacting to a confidential 60-page NYPD report from 2007 that was published this week by the Associated Press. It contains detailed information on dozens of mosques and Muslim-owned businesses in Newark, which is just a few miles west of Manhattan. But on his weekly radio show today, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg says the NYPD needs to collect this kind of intelligence in order to keep the city safe.
Everything the New York City Police Department has done is legal. It is appropriate. It is constitutional. They are permitted to travel beyond the borders of New York City to investigate cases. We don't target individuals based on race or religion.
Politicians across the river in New Jersey don't seem so sure. New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez called for a federal investigation. Even Governor Chris Christie, who prosecuted terror cases as a U.S. attorney, expressed concerns about the NYPD's tactics at a town hall meeting this week.
The NYPD has at times developed a reputation of, asking forgiveness rather than permission.
Christie says the state attorney general is looking into whether the NYPD went beyond its jurisdiction in this case. But the NYPD says it did get permission from the director of Newark's police department. Spokesman Paul Brown insists the NYPD is complying with the law, including special federal guidelines for the department that have been in place since the 1960s.
Not only do we're meeting existing constitutional requirements that exist everywhere in the country, but on top of that, additional requirements under an agreement here in New York.
For all the back and forth this week, it's no secret that the NYPD has operated in New Jersey before. In 2010, an undercover agent in Jersey City helped arrest two would-be jihadists. And in New York City, where aggressive monitoring by the NYPD has been a fact of life for a decade, the revelations about New Jersey were mostly greeted with a shrug. At the Islamic Cultural Center of New York, Imam Omar Abu Namous says he trusts the NYPD.
This is their business, you know, and I don't feel uncomfortable, you know, about their surveilling mosques and other Muslim places, because the city is our city also. We are very keen, you know, that this country be safe and the city be safe.
But the department's tactics do bother Jawad Rasool. He's a member of the Muslim Student Association at City College of New York. According to another NYPD document published this week by the AP, his student association was one of many across the Northeast that were infiltrated by undercover cops. An NYPD officer even accompanied Rasool's group on a whitewater rafting trip. Rasool thinks that is counterproductive.
There are people who may be extremists. There is a large number of people who are not extremists at all, and these kind of tactics can make them an extremist.
That's one risk the NYPD and Mayor Bloomberg have shown they're willing to take. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Gunfire broke out today inside the Interior Ministry in Kabul, Afghanistan. Two high-ranking U.S. military officers have been killed. The incident came on the fifth day of protests across the nation sparked by the burning of Qurans at a U.S. base. NPR's Quill Lawrence joins us from Kabul. Quill, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
What do we know now about the shooting?
Details are still coming in. We know that in the afternoon there were reports that gunfire was heard inside the Interior Ministry, inside a high security area within the ministry. And we have been able to confirm that two, as you said, U.S. military officers, advisors to the Interior Ministry, a colonel and a major, have been killed. But after that, the details get very sketchy. ISAF, that's the NATO mission here, led by General John Allen, a U.S. Army general, have been very vague in their language. They said that the perpetrator was a coward who will be brought to justice, but they haven't said anything about nationality or any other details.
Is there any reason to think or not to think that this is related to the burnings of the Quran for which the United States has apologized?
Now, there have been an uptick in incidents like this where Afghan soldiers have turned their weapons on the American and other NATO trainers and advisors, soldiers here on the ground. That's been on the rise. But this week, there was an incident like that that seems directly linked to the Quran burning. And at the moment, I think everyone is assuming that this was linked to the incident up at Bagram Airfield, which is yet to be explained how this came to happen, that they were incinerating Qurans.
Reaction from the Afghan government?
What we're hearing so far is quite contradictory. No one's confirming, but American officials are saying that they're pretty sure that the perpetrator of this act was not a Westerner, whereas some Afghan sources are saying, no, they don't think it was an Afghan. They think that it had to have been a Western advisor to have reached inside this part of the Interior Ministry. Mm-hmm. So it's very confusing at this point. Of course, reaction to the Quran burnings is still really just anger, universal anger across the country. And we've seen riots with dozens now dead since Monday in provinces across the country.
NPR's Quill Lawrence in Kabul. Thanks so much.
Thank you.